listener production.
A warning. This episode contains graphic references to violence against women. Help is always available at 1-800-RESPECT. Dial 1-800-737-732 or dial Lifeline on 13 11 14. G'day, I'm former police officer Brent Sanders. And for the past 25 years, I've dedicated myself to sharing what I've learnt on the force to the Australian public so they can better protect themselves from falling victim to crime. So with the help of some of the most respected current and former detectives and high-ranking law enforcement agents, I'm going to pull back the curtain on what life is like on the force and what they've learned about how crime and criminals really work. These are real stories from real detectives. This week, a diverse but traumatising career of intense criminal investigations.
Every police officer that was involved in this extensive incident, possibly not just mine, but ended a lot of careers. I know it was the beginning of the end for me.
Luke Taylor is a 14-year veteran of the New South Wales Police Force.
We actually got a hold of the recording from Triple O, and then we played it once. And I remember my commander at the time, he was in there, he just said, "Seal that away, that never gets played again. I don't want any other cops hearing that."
Luke's passion for helping others is what saw him join the force. Tragically, it was also the reason he left the job.
It doesn't have to be a nightmare. You can have it in the middle of the day. You just have certain incidents when you'll think about it and you know you're never going to be completely free from it.
We'll hear about the case, which was the beginning of the end for Luke. But to start, we're going back just before the 2000 Sydney Olympics to a high-rise building in Cabramatta.
Probably about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I remember it was quite a drizzly day. The rain was coming down and there was a report of shots being fired in a set of units in Cabramatta, the other side of the railway line. And when we turned up, it was a set of units right next door to a primary school. And as we've turned up, there was cars and people running everywhere, leaving this block of units, and there was some uniform already there. And we turned up and a fella has run out of the building and the whole front of him is just covered in blood. And we soon worked out that he'd had a gunshot wound to the stomach. And as I think most people can appreciate, those sorts of wounds are pretty treacherous and you want to get to them as soon as possible. He's fallen down into the gutter and the best we could do was try and keep him comfortable in the gutter, putting a rain jacket on him, doing our best to keep him comfortable until the ambulance has arrived. Whilst this is all going on, we're trying to get information out of him and there's an obvious language barrier. He was Vietnamese and he's trying to indicate obviously that he had been shot and that there were offenders somewhere, but he wasn't giving too much up. So we've got this building, it's approximately 5 stories. At this stage, we've got it cordoned off. We've sent people around the outside of the building to make sure there's no other exits. So at this stage, we're pretty confident that we've got things contained within this block of units. But within that block of units, we've possibly got 5 levels with 4 to 6 dwellings on each level. So we've potentially got, 50 to 100 people in this building. From there, we've basically got inside. We think, okay, we've got some armed offenders inside there. We've gone running up and we've just started a systematic search of each level. And we've cleared each room, each house, each apartment building on each level. And we've got to the very top. At that point, we find 7 occupants in this particular room. And most of them are young. And then there's an older lady that's also with them. 6 guys, 2 women. And as we start talking to them to find out what's going on, they start telling us, yep, we've heard shots fired. And they're giving us parts of a story and none of it is fully making sense. But what we noticed was that there was a young couple, a guy and a girl who seemed to be boy and girlfriend, completely dominated. So every time I went to ask them a question, these other guys would talk over the top of them. They would give their response and they would give some answers. the older lady, turns out it was the grandmother, didn't speak a word of English either. So we had these communication problems. These guys are selling us this story about shots being fired and people have left the building. At this stage, we had a police bus turn up because it was, you know, we had a Beats unit down the road, and Beats was a big thing in Cabramatta at the time. There was so much, you know, street level crime going on. So I thought, right, let's send them down, get them on the bus and start separating them so we can talk to them. I've gone downstairs, started talking to these guys. And again, every time I go to talk to this particular girl and the guy who seems to be closest to her, a couple of the fellas start talking over the top. And then they say, oh, they don't understand English. We will interpret for you. There's something going on here. And I worked out that they were actually Thai and these other people were Vietnamese. So we pulled them off the bus and I've taken this other couple away and separated them and told them, just leave the bus there, just watch over them. And got on the phone and done a telephone interpreter. That's when we found out that these guys were the offenders and they'd taken them hostage. And of course they'd threatened them. And the fact that they did have firearms and they're up somewhere inside that house. So we've gone back up through the units and we're searching through there. Look out the window. There's a window slightly open. So we've opened the window and had a look. And here's a couple of sawn-off shotguns that had actually been thrown out of the building and inside the schoolyard. Now, we got kids playing at lunchtime, even though it was raining. There were kids out running around at lunchtime in the playground. And here's a couple of big, dirty, great black sawn-off shotties just sitting in the playground. So we've had to, you know, send the team down there right the way around and trying to call off. We're yelling out the windows to try and get the teacher's attention to keep these kids away while we get the sawn-off shotguns, bring them in, take them back to the police station. Anyway, we're talking about 20 hours of interviews going through all of this particular incident just to get to the bottom of it. So we got one Vietnamese gang after another Vietnamese gang for drug dealing. Now, it wasn't 5T. We're talking about a time, you mentioned 2000. It was the demise of the 5T gang there that had run things pretty much with an iron fist for so long. And after the death of a few years earlier of Tree Minh Tran, they'd started to lose that control. So you just had you had this market where everyone was a player and everyone was trying to get their piece of the pie. So there was no real control. And this was becoming such an everyday occurrence, just trying to take out and eliminate their opposition. And this is what happened in broad daylight. They went in, do a home invasion, try and get the drugs and put the others off. So the guy who'd actually come out bleeding and been shot in the stomach, he was a dealer himself as well, which is why he wasn't giving us too much information at the time. 18 months later, when we're going to court, we can't get the firearms into evidence. So it goes to court. I think we've been in voir dire for about 3 days trying to get evidence and trying to get an ex parte evidence in for the first of our victims, the one who was taken hostage. He's gone back to Thailand and had to do 2 years military service. And the Thai government wouldn't release him to come back and give evidence. So we had this incredible, 3 days of voir dire, just trying to get his evidence accepted ex parte, and no go. Because he was the only one that could link the guns, that was all thrown out as well.
How do you proceed with that case? What's the end result there?
It turned out to be not much more than an assault, the deprivation of liberty, but yeah, the malwounding, anything like that. Even the fellow that was shot didn't want to give evidence. And that was a real eye-opener for me because I was quite junior in the detectives at that stage. And I was probably fourth or fifth person to give evidence in that trial. And so when I've come in, I had no idea the other evidence that had been given up to that point. You obviously cannot hear the evidence that other people are giving, so it doesn't influence your own evidence. So when I've gone in there and I've been handed this incredibly redacted statement, and the DPP start leading me through, and I've been handed like what was a 5-page statement, and I've got 2 or 3 pages have been redacted. And I think the DPP solicitor or the barrister has seen the look in my face as sort of I'm looking at the jury and I'm looking up at him as if to say, why is all my evidence? And he's led me through it. And there's just these massive gaps. And I'll now take you to this bit where you interviewed. And I'm looking at him as if to say, well, what about when I've gone upstairs, I've found the guns, I've found this, I've done that. And he has just seen the frustration. He looked at the judge and called for an adjournment and got me outside and just explained. He said, look, fingerprints, he said, we cannot, he said, the firearms are not in evidence. You cannot mention them. And he said, if you mention them, if you say anything, he said, you'll be in contempt of court. He said, it'll be a mistrial. He said, do not utter a word about them. He said, we've just got to move on with what we've got. I think it was probably my second or third year in the police and straight into detectives, and I thought, wow, this is a real eye-opener. It is. It's such a game. It's so different. Like, you've got the heat of the moment, you've got the action, and then you've got the cold, harsh reality, like a couple of years down the track in a very cold courtroom. And then also you've then got to explain to all these witnesses and victims and families the end result as to why it hasn't ended up the way we think natural justice should be served.
That's really interesting you say that, Luke, because as you say, you're recalling an incident that you worked on as a relatively new detective a couple of years in the job. That enthusiasm that you perhaps have as that young detective soon gets overridden by the reality that the real win, I think, is we've got this case to court. We've got it into a courtroom environment. Now, what happens after that? Well, that's out of your control. But you do the best brief you can. You go in there and give your evidence, and the rest is in the lap of the gods, I guess, isn't it?
It is too. And like I said, and there's plenty you don't get up at court. That's the thing. But every single, you know, if you want to talk about recidivist offenders, and a lot of them are, they are going to have another appearance at some stage, and you just keep chipping away. And like I said, you just know you're doing your part. It doesn't take away from the fact that that day in court, I just wanted to look at the jury and say, what about the shotguns? You've got to be kidding me. But yeah, luckily I had some good people around me, and as frustrated as I was behind the scenes in that adjournment, I had a couple of really good detective sergeants that put their arm around me and said, do not cross the line, just go in there and just play the game. And I'm forever thankful for that.
Old mate with the shotgun to the stomach, did you bump into him? And what about the others? Did they sort of come back around through yourself?
Not that I recall. It probably wasn't too much after that that I moved on to another area, but it was almost comical at the time. Being a very junior detective, working in an office with very senior detectives, with that draw of police officers to the Olympic movement, they basically went through all the detective senior constables in our office and said, right, you've got to go to the Olympics, acting sergeant positions and various. So I think there was four of us out of 16 left in our office. So we were virtually on call every night. And at one point there was malwoundings, shootings and stabbings. There was about, I remember there was 50 odd in a month. And you just, every night you'd get home, you'd have dinner. And next thing you know, the phone's going and you'd be back out. And I know I'm over-sensationalising or making this a little bit comical, but it was, I remember one guy, a guy's laying in the Cumberland Highway, somewhere between, off towards Liverpool, between Liverpool and Cabramatta. They use a very small, I think it was a 32, a very small handgun. It was easily concealed, and they'd be shot. It wouldn't cause a lot of death, these small caliber guns. Guy's just laying in the road bleeding, and the ambulance is coming, and he's virtually saying, no, thank you, sir. I'm all right. No statement. I'll deal with this. No worries. And you know that he'll come back out tomorrow and just take revenge. So you'll be coming out again, racking up a few more hours overtime and just writing another one off. So it was chaotic. It was just craziness. But again, somebody was going to get caught in the crossfire. It was just out of control at that time.
The next case that we're going to have a chat about is quite simply an exceedingly violent case. Can you walk us through this case, Luke, and your involvement in it?
Yeah, Brent, this was easily the worst case I've been involved in. And I know not just myself, but every police officer that was involved in this extensive incident, just how much it affected and possibly not just mine, but ended a lot of careers. I know it was the beginning of the end for me. So a young mother in her mid-30s, she was estranged from her husband. She was out in the west of Sydney, and the husband lived, probably an hour away. And her teenage son, who was about 19, went with the husband and lived with him. And there was a lot of drug use and mental health issues involved. And she also had a 15-year-old daughter who was in her custody, so she stayed at home with her. Now, she was a shift worker, she was a nurse, and during the night, the husband and the son decided to catch a train down and go over to see the daughter while she wasn't at home. Now, they later admitted to having about 40 cones in the lead up to that, so we're talking about an excessive amount of pot smoking and all the hallucinations and the mental health issues, the schizophrenia that goes on with that. So they made their way over to her house. They convinced the daughter or the sister to let them in. And during the night, they took part in some devil worshipping, and they convinced the daughter that mum had died in a car accident during the night, and that a demon has possessed, or the devil has possessed her body, and that when she comes home in the morning, it's not actually mum, but a devil has taken possession of her body, and we must exorcise the demon from her body. And they were drinking out of chalices with, you know, red wine, pretending it was, blood, and they did an upside-down pentagram on the carpet. So about 8 o'clock in the next morning, when mum's come home from the night shift, basically just put the key in the screen door to open it, and they've kicked the door open from the inside, knocked her flying, and all three of them have attacked her with really large kitchen knives and started stabbing her, and she's run off through the front yard. There's a couple of little girls and their mum waiting for a bus to go to school. She's run past them. They've scattered, and she's pulled out her mobile phone and started ringing 000. So for the next few minutes, 000 was recording it as she was identifying what was going on and saying, look, you know, husband and my son and my daughter, they're killing me. She's run over the road into the house, and she's run through their hallway, taken the house phone and started to ring the police or do something. They've run in, they've knocked the phone off the wall. They've run through past their family. They've chased her into the backyard. She's run around and ended up about three doors down from where she started, at which point they were stabbing her in the back and different things. And she's eventually collapsed in the front yard, and they've continued to kill her in the most graphic and inhumane butchering, I think a lot of us have ever seen. And all this was recorded on 000 at the time as well. Unfortunately, you can hear her screams of anguish, and you can hear them chasing and what they're saying. The uniform guys that turned up, when they turned up, they were actually standing around the dying lady, and they were incanting devil worships, talking about Beelzebub, Mephistopheles, and saying all this weird stuff. And they were detained. I was sprayed, detained, and got in the back of the truck. And I think I was only a couple of minutes behind them, and got there and tried to render first aid and save the body. But yeah, she was clearly gone at that particular stage.
Luke, these are stories that they stay with you, and as you're very honestly said, this was the beginning of the end for you in the job. This is a story that, I guess, coupled with so many other things that you see. I mean, this on its own in its isolation is a shocking, shocking story. But, you know, for a guy that had been in the job for many, many years, this gets to a point where you can only take so much. And in fact, there are injuries inflicted on this poor woman that are actually too graphic for us to even go into any detail to. You assisted in that investigation. You assisted with the autopsy. Obviously, it's a coroner's case. And there's no winners. It's just all ends up. It's a shocking case, isn't it, mate?
Oh, completely. The amount of people it affected, like you said, you've got people in the street, you've got neighbours, you've got family, you've got friends, and you've got, hopefully, at some stage, you've got a son and a daughter for whatever part they had in this event, and whether how they were affected. You just hope at some point there will be some clarity. But unfortunately for them too, if there is some sort of clarity, and then they're going to have to live with this as well. And like I said, the amount of police that were involved, and look, I remember it might have been the next day when the entire office got together and we were working out the next stage of the investigation and tying things up. And we actually got a hold of the recording from 000, and we played it in our detective's office, and we actually didn't let anyone else in. It was just, and then we played it once. And I remember my commander at the time, he was in there. He just said, seal that away. That never gets played again. I don't want any other cops hearing that. And honestly, I don't know whether I was, it was something that, yeah, I don't know whether I'm not going to say I'm glad I heard it, but you always have curiosity. So in that way, I got to hear it. But then the other ways, I wish I'd never heard it, even though I heard it live as we were going out there at the time. It's just something you got to live with. And then even, yeah, as I said, at the pathologist at over at Westmead. She worked at Westmead. She was a nurse at Westmead. And that's where the coroner's court is. And like I said, it was purely by chance. I just had a foot operation at the time, so I was the least capable of any field work. I sort of got the job of going to the coroner's there and doing the autopsy. But just the level of emotion that was going through Westmead Hospital at the time, because it was just, it was unbelievable. It's something I've never felt before, and luckily I'm out of the job and I'll never have to experience anything like that again.
Can I ask you, what year was this? What year was this incident, this case?
Might be about 05.
You ended up leaving the job in 09. And I'm just going to take you back to the point that you made, that this case was the beginning of the end for you. So you carried that and all everything that entails with you for the next 4 years as an active police officer. But you can look back now and say that when you left the job in 09, that downhill slide, if I can call it that, I hope that's not being too melodramatic, started on the back of this case some 4 years earlier.
Yeah, very much so. It's like, I often felt for many years, I didn't question myself, wondering if I was just this cold human being, because for so many years I'd been able to remain emotionally detached. And I think a lot of that was youthful exuberance. I loved the job. I never saw myself doing anything different. I loved the investigating, the researching, and the intellectual side of everything that we did as a detective. There were times where I'm thinking, wow, am I just emotionally detached? Why aren't these things affecting me? And as a young cop growing up, and you hear about people falling off the perch, and you think it's a disease that some people catch, going off with head noises, as we used to say. And it was this great mystery around this. You'd always see on the roster each morning all these people off long-term sick, and you'd never get to meet half of them, and it wasn't spoken about. And so I'd remained so indifferent and cold to any sort of mental health issues and getting really emotionally involved. But possibly that was the wrong way, the right way, I don't know. And I know enough now not to even question that. But this was certainly the first one that, it hit me like a ton of bricks. It's the one now I still see it. It doesn't have to be a nightmare. You can have it in the middle of the day. You just have certain incidents when you'll think about it, and you know you're never going to be completely free from it. And it's often there were innocuous things that happened in the job, and at the time, they don't worry you. If there was adrenaline, you name it, different things going on. But then when they start to take their toll, you even start to revisit the other things. You don't recognise all those straws building up until there's that one that breaks the camel's back. But this one, the nightmares for this one were long-lasting.
You left the job 2009, and please don't hesitate to pull me up if we're going into an area that you'd rather not discuss. But after 14 years in the job, your world literally came crashing down around you.
Yeah, completely. Just been fighting the system. And there was a few incidents in there as well, issues that I think we all face from time to time, issues with management and the way things are being dealt with that doesn't make your job any easier, and there's no way out. And, I went to child protection, the sex crimes unit. So for the last 3 years, we're working in that industry. And that was around about the time my little girl was growing up as well. And you keep fighting and fighting, and you're fighting the system, and you're trying to put on that brave face because I think there's a double-edged sword there, not only as police officers or military, paramilitary, you're trained and there's a certain stoicism in doing the job, but I think also the double-edged sword of also being a male, where you have this silly notion of being the provider and you've got these paternal instincts and, patriarchy and that's what you do in life. And you just put things off and deny it, and you just keep going and going and going. And and I woke up one morning. I remember I was in a trial. I had three trials going on at the same time. I was up the mid-north coast, one down in Penrith, one in Port Macquarie, and one in Taree. And there's no way I could, be at three district court trials all at the same time. And somehow I'm juggling three district trials at once, and my world just came crashing down one day in the witness box, and I just, yeah, like I couldn't be in three places at once, and I just got no support. So the judge took it out on me at Taree District Court, and I just remember trying to drive home that afternoon and just fell in a heap, and I had another judge complaining that I wasn't there, and they talked about issuing bench warrants to have me arrested. That's how crazy things became on top of everything else that was going on. And so a judge has actually phoned an assistant commissioner at crime agencies, and apparently they couldn't explain it. So they said, oh, we're going to issue, if he doesn't appear tomorrow, we're going to issue a bench warrant. And when that call's come through, I just kept driving. I just drove back up the coast to where I was living, and at the end of the day, and I kept going straight into a doctor's, and it's the first time I've just walked in and I have just broke down. And his doctor wasn't very supportive, but he just said, oh, well, you need a less stressful job. Why don't you go and grow flowers? So I took a couple of days off and went back. And yeah, this just kept going on for a while. They took my gun off me because I was unstable and showing signs. So I'm this basket case. And unfortunately, I now see it as weakness, man. I was too weak to put my hand up and say, I need help. Like, there were times, even going back to my Cabramatta days when, you know, and this first happened, I had days there where you pull that car over to the side of the road, and you question, can you go on, and you just need help. I could never ask for help for myself, unfortunately, Brent. I was a union delegate, and I'd bend over backwards to try and get everything right for everyone and protect their rights. But then I remember going, you know, who's going to fight for my rights and who's going to help me? And it came down to just me, but it took a long time and did a lot of damage before I started getting on the road to recovery. And I just couldn't do the job anymore. I was a mess.
And look, that road to recovery, tragically, but perhaps the other side of the coin is it was a start of your moving forward, as you ended up doing a stint in Northside Mental Health Unit. Things had got that bad, and a lot of therapy to get you from where you were through that and out the other side.
That's right, Brent. And look, and it's something that I know I have to keep on top of today. And I've got a counsellor, and I check in a couple of times a year when I'm going well, when I'm going bad, you name it. We know about medication. I still take medication. I'm not afraid to talk about that. And it's been one of the great things in my transition, dealing with kids and dealing with people and doing what I'm doing, is being open about mental health. And I've come to see mental health as being just like any other form of injury. And we've got to acknowledge it as being like a physical injury. If I hurt my leg, I'm going to go to a physio. I'm going to go to an orthopedic surgeon. I'm going to rehab. Or I might even have to take a painkiller and things like that. And mental health is exactly the same. You use your brain for different components, it will wear out. The bricklayer who does his back after many years of bending over laying bricks, there's that breaking point, and we got to acknowledge it and understand it. But what I'm also seeing is the positive and the beautiful side of it is the brain is such an incredible and a complex instrument, that this neuroplasticity and how we can develop new pathways and new strengths within our brains, it just takes a lot of hard work, and you've got to have the right supports in place to get there. I've got a great family, and next time around, I bumped into the best GP I could ever have asked for, who, as a doctor, had gone through PTSD, and he just knew what we were going through and put me in touch with the right counsellors, the right people, and that was the start. It was basically just like a big warm hug to say, hey, there is a light, you will get there if you work hard and you follow these steps, just trust us, and these were the right people to trust in. When you spoke about going to Northside down at Westmead there, the mental health clinic, that actually came about after the police. Going through the whole process, I think I had to tell my entire story to 17 different specialists just in that process of leaving the police. It was, and you're reliving it, and it's actually torturous going through that. And I continued, so you keep going for years afterwards. You're living it constantly and reliving it, and you're going through so many different specialists and so many different procedures within the police, and, you know, and then the workers' comp schemes and all that, and you can never escape it. I got to a point years down the track and I said, look, I've just got to try and move on and draw a line in the sand. And at one point there to try and, I hadn't left the home for 2 years. A mate of mine said, look, you want to come and just help out in the back of a shop somewhere and do some menial tasks and things just to sort of get out into society again. And you do that. And then obviously years later, I've started studying and started studying literature. Always loved literature, everything about writing, literacy and that. And so I was halfway through that degree and I started volunteering at a local school and doing some work there. And then converted that degree and got myself an English teacher degree. But unfortunately, just when you think you're safe, you're secure, you're moving on, I then just let the pressures get to me again. And second time around, and for me, it was wondering, like, I had this brilliant career as a detective, loved it. I couldn't see myself doing anything different. And then I got this incredible fear come to me saying that I lost that. What if this happens again? What if this is a repeating process? Like, I've got the perfect job. What if it's taken from me again by circumstances out of my control? And this lack of confidence and this fear hits, and I ended up in an absolute hole. And that's when I ended up in a mental health clinic because I just couldn't deal with it. So every time is just a new learning process. But I realized you can never let it go completely. You've just got to put things in place. And I know my brain is now so different. Like, I can't handle pressure. The things that I used to do, like some of the court case, you'd be taking 50, witnesses to court, you'd be juggling everything. Now, I know I can't do that anymore. I just simply cannot do it. But my brain works in other ways. I got a lot more compassion, a lot more empathy, understanding. I'm slower to do things and it's just completely different. It's not better. It's not worse, just different. And you embrace that and you just got to try and make the most of that with wherever you need to be in the world.
I just want to thank you so much for your service. Thank you so much for coming in and for your honesty. And I just know that so many listening will take so much from you sitting there and sharing this with us. Thanks so much. It's been a privilege to meet you, Luke.
Likewise, Brent. Thank you very much. And like I said, to listeners out there, we all know someone who's going through tough times, and just be there, just listen, and they'll open up.
Crime Insiders Detectives is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Brent Sanders, produced by Ed Gooden, and sound designed and imaged by Link Kelly.